Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, we discuss the impact of the Supreme Court abortion draft on the Pennsylvania primaries, also the many benefits of horticulture therapy. But to begin, we discuss a tragic and complicated story. 12-year-old TJ Sedaria was less than a month from celebrating his 13th birthday when he was allegedly shot and killed by a Philadelphia police officer in South Philadelphia. The fatal shooting happened March 1st, just moments after TJ is said to have fired a gun at an unmarked police car, shattering the back window. The plainclothes officers inside had been planning to stop TJ and a 17-year-old for questioning, but according to a grand jury report, when an officer turned on the car's police lights, one of the youths opened fire. District Attorney Larry Krasner says the gunman was likely TJ. Surveillance video apparently shows the boy running up the street and tossing a gun, a 9mm handgun with a laser. TJ either fell or dropped to the ground. And seconds later, Officer Edsel Mendoza allegedly fired the shot that would take TJ's life. Mendoza is now facing charges which include first and third degree murder. Rodrigo Torrejon is a breaking news and general assignment reporter at the Philadelphia Inquirer. He has been covering this story and joins us now. Rodrigo, welcome.
Hi, Mary. Thanks for having me.
So a 12-year-old is dead, and a 26-year-old Philadelphia police officer, now a former officer, has been fired and is facing murder charges. Let's discuss the night of TJ's death. Tell us a bit about the officers who are part of what's called the South Task Force and what they were doing that night.
Sure. So Edsel Mendoza, along with three other officers, Kwaku Sarpong, Robert Cuccinelli, and Alexander Camacho, had been staking out the area of Berry Playground, 18th Street, on a social media posting that they had seen, where a 20-year-old and a 17-year-old, both unnamed as of now, were brandishing weapons, guns. So they were there supposedly staking out the area for that report when they saw TJ and a 17-year-old, also unidentified as of yet, in the area on their bikes.
Were they wearing body cameras?
I believe they were not wearing body cameras at the time.
Okay. So when one of the officers turns on the unmarked car's lights, a bullet goes through the back window, and one of the officers is injured. Glass flies into his eyes. Two officers shoot, but only one takes off after TJ. What do we know about what happens next?
Sure. So according to all of the reporting and the records, and also DA Krasner's press conference, around the time, almost simultaneously when the shot was fired through the back window of the unmarked police car, Officer Sarpong had flicked on the lights, the car's lights. It's still unclear the sequence, but almost essentially at the same time, the shot rang out, went through the back window, shattered glass that ended up injuring Officer Camacho. At the time, Mendoza and Sarpong took chase, return fire, and Mendoza took chase after TJ. It's at this point that, from what Krasner has said in the press conference, based on footage that they've reviewed and the grand jury's reviewed and offered in the presentment, that Edsel Mendoza actually asked TJ to drop the gun and get on the ground. We, in previous investigations at the Inquirer, we had an estimate that he had dropped, TJ Sedaria had dropped the gun approximately 60 feet from where he was ended up shot and killed down that street. Krasner in the press conference said that it was approximately 40 feet. So in the press conference, DA Krasner said that there's a heavy indication that Mendoza at the time knew that TJ had actually dropped the gun and was unarmed at the time that he was shot, and that he was within a half car length approximately of TJ when he shot him in the back, the fatal shot.
He is stopping short. Krasner is stopping short of calling it an execution.
Yeah, the few people offered that as essentially the assertion to be made. Krasner would not say that, but he is stopping just short of that. It's essentially at point blank range based on the estimates of distance that he gave at the press conference.
And Rodrigo, is it clear as to why the officers were planning to question TJ and the 17-year-old in the first place?
There's differing accounts from the four officers. Officer Sarpong said that they just wanted to talk to them. According to Officer Camacho, the 17-year-old that was with TJ may have known the 20-year-old that had posted on social media with a gun. And I believe the other officer said that they were going to give the two boys a ticket for riding in the wrong direction on their bikes. So there's differing accounts as to what they were going to do and what the stops were for.
There seems to be little dispute, though, that TJ fired the shot, the initial shot that shattered the window. Is that correct?
No. As of now, most of the reporting and also statements from police officials and Krasner have said that there's a heavy indication that TJ was the one who fired the shot into the back of the car window with the Taurus 9mm that was found.
Let's talk about TJ Sedario's very short life. He was 12, again. And by all accounts, Rodrigo, he had a turbulent childhood. Tell us more.
Sure. So, yeah, TJ Sedario, he definitely had a tumultuous upbringing. In speaking with family members and friends, people that helped raise him, he kind of had a life where he was bouncing from household to household. I've spoken at length to and continue to speak to Mark Nizzuti, who considered TJ his nephew and actually helped TJ's great aunt, who is now passed, raise him. He tried to do the best that he could, Mark did, to help him, you know, whether it was buying clothes or toys. But TJ often, according to Nizzuti, would get in fights with family members that he was staying at. And he had a large network of friends in South Philly, people that he considered his extended family, that he would end up, he would have a fight with someone, and then he would go to that person's house, maybe have a fight with them, and then outstay the welcome and go to another person's house. So he was kind of all over the place. Along with that, his father, Thomas Sedario, who is currently incarcerated and has been for a few years, all said he will have been out of his life for approximately 3 years at this point. And then his mother has had run-ins with the law as well. And she's in and out of his life as well. I believe he was staying with her at the time that he was shot and killed. But again, based on conversations with friends and family, he was kind of a nomad in that he would go from friends and family's house to friends and family's house.
Philadelphia Police Commissioner Danielle Outlaw has said, "We as a society have failed him," meaning TJ. She got some flack on social media for this, didn't she?
Yeah, I think people took what she said as, you know, either shrugging responsibility or placing it somewhere else. But the reality is TJ's from a community that is beset by gun violence. I mean, the city at large is beset by the gun violence crisis. And TJ did have to deal with a lot of, you know, family issues that were out of his control.
There has been some discussion about the attention this particular case is getting. TJ was white. We recently did another segment on the roundup on the deadly gun violence. You know, children of color have been shot and killed, but they don't generally receive a nationwide focus. Rodrigo, what are you hearing about this?
So I wouldn't want to comment too much on the national conversation other than to say that the reality is that the gun violence crisis, not just in Philadelphia, but across the country, does disproportionately affect the communities of color, the BIPOC community, particularly in Philadelphia. The black community, it's something that the black community unfortunately has to deal with daily, almost daily at this point. You know, we're on pace for potentially another record-breaking year in terms of gun homicides. And as far as the conversation with this, I think the Inquirer did a great job at giving this story the attention it deserves, which at the core of the story is a 12-year-old boy was shot and killed by police. It's the youngest boy since at least before 2009, so more than 10 years that a child this young has been shot and killed by a Philly police officer.
So former officer Edsall Mendoza has been charged with first-degree murder.
Yes.
Is this unusual when it comes to this sort of situation involving Philadelphia police officers?
Sure. Statistically, it's relatively unusual. It's not something that happens too frequently. Since 2018, when DA Krasner took office, this Mendoza would be the third Philadelphia police officer, and I guess at this point, former Philadelphia police officer that has been charged with murder. In 2018, Ryan Pownell, a former Philadelphia police officer, was also charged with murder for shooting a person similarly in the back, although he was not on the ground. And that, of course, raised a bunch of questions pertaining to TJ's case because of the similarity in where he was shot, whether or not he had surrendered, if he was prone or if he was running away, whether essentially, again, the ultimate question is whether he was a threat. And then I believe in also from a 2017 incident, Eric Ruch, another former Philadelphia police officer, was charged in 2020, I believe, for murder.
So Larry Krasner says he is not releasing the surveillance video regarding the shooting death of TJ Sedario at this point, right?
Yeah, at this point, I don't think so, but particularly because the investigation has just started and there hasn't even been a trial date set or any kind of hearing date set, really.
This has all moved so quickly. Unusually so?
I would say so. I think it's, you know, the time between the TJ's shooting, the fatal shooting.
And March 1st. Yeah.
March 1st, and then March 8th, Mendoza, or Commissioner Danielle Outlaw, said that Mendoza would be fired, and they started the process of his suspension, the 30-day suspension leading towards his firing. That itself was pretty quick. And then after that, I mean, it's only been 2 months, and Mendoza surrendered last Sunday and is now charged with murder. I think it did move pretty quickly, and I think part of that is likely what Krasner has been saying, which is that the video footage that shows what transpired that we have yet to see is pretty damning.
Mm. And so far, we're not hearing much from the union. What does that say or indicate, do you think?
I don't know what it would indicate. What I do know is that the union has so far just kind of stuck to the basic point that Mendoza has the same due process rights as everyone else and has really not said much about it. They haven't really been as vocal in, I wouldn't say support, but they haven't really said much at this point.
Both of TJ's parents are planning to sue, is that correct?
Yes. Last Monday, so the day after Mendoza surrendered, Andrew Duffy, the attorney for Desiree Frame, TJ's mother, had a short press conference reiterating Ms. Frame's, state of utter sadness and just grief and mourning, but also went on to say that within the next few weeks, they would likely be filing a civil action suit naming Mendoza, the city, and the Philadelphia Police Department. That's the extent of the details that we have at this point. But I believe the attorney for TJ's father has also said that a suit is forthcoming.
Okay, we've got about 10 seconds. Sure. Any hearing set up yet for Ed Saul Mendoza or the next step?
Not as of now that we know of, that those civil suits are the ones that are forthcoming.
Yep. All right, Rodrigo Torrejon, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much,
appreciate it. Rodrigo is breaking news and general assignment reporter at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Up next, we talk about the leaked Supreme Court draft decision on abortion and how that might affect the Pennsylvania primaries. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Welcome back. Stakes have grown even higher in the already fraught upcoming Pennsylvania primary election following the leak of a Supreme Court draft decision which would overturn Roe v. Wade. Incumbent Governor Wolf, a Democrat, responded by saying he will protect access to abortion in the state, but he can only do so for the remainder of his term, which ends in mid-January. The candidates who would replace him have taken up the issue. The lone Democratic candidate in the primary, Attorney General Josh Shapiro, supports abortion rights, but the Republican gubernatorial candidates say they would prohibit or limit access to abortions. The leak at the Supreme Court is also impacting U.S. Senate and House primaries in Pennsylvania and state races as well. Pennsylvania's legislature is Republican majority, and some GOP lawmakers have introduced legislation which would restrict abortion rights through a constitutional amendment. There's lots to talk about. Lines are open at 888-477-9499. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Danielle Gross is a Democratic strategist and director of communications at Shelley Lyons Public Affairs. Hello, Danielle.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure. We also welcome Jesri Friend, a Pennsylvania Republican State Party committee member. Hi, Jesri.
Hey, Mary. Pleasure to be here.
Thanks for joining us. So first, let's get your reactions to the leak of the Supreme Court draft. And again, the draft document would overturn Roe in its entirety, sending the question of abortion back to the states. Jesri, to you first. Did you think the court would be considering something so sweeping?
Well, that was a speculation, right, Mary? For a long time, it was out there with now having a 6-3 conservative majority that it wasn't will it happen, but when will it happen? There's been speculation in the conservative, well, not even conservative, but in political circles that this would be a big part of the general elections come this fall. However, I don't think anyone could have predicted something like this, where we're talking about it a week out from the primary here in Pennsylvania.
Danielle, let's get your thoughts. I think there's obviously a lot of shock just a week ago when this draft document was leaked, but the scope of it, I mean, overturning Roe v. Wade entirely, I mean, were you surprised?
You know, I wasn't surprised. I've been told my whole life that this would never happen. But like many women, I didn't really believe it. And it's important to note that currently right now, the abortion is definitely still legal. This is a draft opinion. But overturning Roe means that 26 states could swiftly move to ban abortion. And there are 13 states with laws that would immediately go into effect. So that means 36 million women, half the women of reproductive age in the United States, and people who can become pregnant could lose abortion access as soon as if this ruling becomes final.
Yeah. In Pennsylvania, though, there is no such trigger law, at least at this moment. So the governor's race is a lot of attention being paid because, again, Governor Wolf has said that he will protect access to abortion as long as he's in office. But he is term limited. So let's get to the race and the candidates. State Attorney General Josh Shapiro is the presumptive Democratic gubernatorial nominee. The front runner among the Republicans vying for the GOP nomination is State Senator Doug Mastriano. He is widely thought to be someone Republicans don't necessarily want to win May 17th, in part because he's still talking about 2020 and unfounded allegations of fraud. But again, he is in the lead, and he is somebody who supports a ban on abortions after 6 weeks. Jesri, what's your take on what the GOP wants with this particular candidate?
Well, with this particular candidate, you know, you talk about the position of abortion that really kind of stretches across all Republican candidates. You'd be hard pressed in today's times to have someone leading on a statewide ticket who isn't considered pro-life. Now, there's semantical lines being drawn on where that falls, but by and large, regardless of who the Republican candidate is here a week from tomorrow, they're going to be a pro-life candidate.
Danielle, I'd like to get your thoughts about a TV ad which seemingly touts Mastriano's positions. The copy reads, he wants to end vote by mail, and he led the fight to audit the 2020 election. If Mastriano wins, it's a win for what Donald Trump stands for. But you know, the ad also asks, is this what we want in Pennsylvania? It's paid for by Democrat Josh Shapiro's campaign. What do you think? Who does Shapiro not want to run against? Apparently, it looks as if he's trying to get Mastriano so that he can beat Mastriano. What's your take on this?
Well, I mean, quite frankly, there are a lot of people in the Capitol who are Republicans who also don't want Mastriano to win. To me, I think the most dangerous part of a Mastriano campaign is the fact that he's clearly indicated that he will not work together in a bipartisan fashion. He has no intentions of doing so. And if he wins, it will mean disaster, not only for a continued blocking of any kind of bipartisan efforts in the Capitol, but it will block efforts from the more moderate members of his own party. Doug Mastriano is the candidate who is the most extreme. But honestly, most of the candidates running for governor on the Republican ticket are extreme. He's just currently the front runner. So I think that's why he's become the target to start.
Okay. The primary races for U.S. Senate, 3 Democrats, Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman, Congressman Connor Lamb, State Representative Malcolm Kenyatta, all hit back at the Supreme Court draft saying they support abortion rights. Responses from the GOP candidates, including Kathy Barnett, Jeff Bardos, Mehmet Oz, David McCormick, Carla Sands, all indicate support for the draft decision. Danielle, how much weight does this early document carry in the primary races for U.S. Senate? What's your thought here?
I believe it'll be a major driver. I mean, there is polling that shows, we've talked about how a majority of Republican candidates are support restricting abortion, but that's not what the polling shows that people want. Abortion is a key factor in driving voters to support Democrats who support abortion access over Republicans who want to ban abortion by 71 points, which is the biggest driver among a whole lot of different issues. Most people, 83% of people, don't want their state passing new laws that would restrict abortion. So this should be a major driver in not only the primary, but in the fall, in the election in the fall.
Chesri, for the moment, Oz is the front runner. He won the endorsement of Donald Trump. His fellow GOP candidates for Senate accuse him of not being pro-life enough because of some statements he's made in the past and of being an outsider. He has a home in New Jersey. Recent polls show the race is tightening between Oz, McCormick, and Barnett. How do you read former President Trump's influence in this race?
Yeah, that's really interesting. It seems to be a three-way tie at this point. In fact, yesterday, Trafalgar poll came out and showed Oz with a very tight lead at 24.5. But the interesting story there is Kathy Barnett coming in at second with 23.2. McCormick fell a point, I believe, and the margin of error is just under 3, which puts that at a virtual three-way dead tie. What's of note there is the endorsement of President Trump, as it did in Ohio, gave a significant boost to his endorsed candidate in Ohio. However, in Pennsylvania, we saw a marginal boost of only about 1 to 2% jump. What's more interesting is how Kathy Barnett lately has jumped about 11 points in the last 2 weeks. Specifically, we're talking about how does abortion influence that. That's been one of the stronger talking points of Miss Barnett. Interestingly, being the product of a rape, I believe her story goes her mother was 11 years old, becomes pregnant, decides to have her. And so it's been one of her talking points for a while where she's been leading from it. I'm wondering how much now that has been able to correlate her large jump. No doubt the abortion issue is polarizing amongst both sides. It seems to be, you know, when you don't have good policy talking points or you don't have forward thinking things, you go back to the tried and true political basics. And we saw here the polling numbers for a Governor Wolf influencing the governor's election, and as well as President Biden influencing the U.S. Senate election. The numbers are low right now. So it is a kind of a cling, it seems to be, amongst the Democratic leading candidates to push back to, hey, let's go back to the basic issues instead of talking about the future things. And now it's definitely no doubt. There's no way around it. Hmm. This is going to be one of the largest issues this fall.
Danielle, your thoughts here?
Well, anyone who's paid attention to how the gubernatorial candidates and the Senate candidates running together really shouldn't be surprised because Kathy Barnett and Doug Mastriano are more or less kind of running together in quotation marks. They're basically have the same base, the same support, and those people are going to support them no matter what. To me, it's not abortion that is a distinguishing mark. You know, despite how compelling Ms. Barnett's personal story is, because so many of the other candidates have opinions regarding abortion that are more or less the same. And let's be clear, this isn't just about abortion. This is a coordinated, slow unraveling of our rights. And, you know, this could very well topple several other rights, you know, things as closely related to abortion care as birth control, you know, marriage equality. There are all kinds of things. So this is a slippery slope.
Yeah, and that might actually partially at least answer a question from Brian, who asks, please speak to how this will effectively ban IVS and IUI procedures, which give life. The loss of Roe will handcuff fertility treatment. Not sure, you know, what the veracity is of this statement, but I think you might have addressed this, Danielle, or at least kind of walked around, because there are concerns again about kind of a domino effect of what Roe might have.
Right. And there is some talk of a statewide constitutional amendment that would be pushed out of the health committee that would give fertilized eggs personhood. And that would certainly handcuff IVF, which creates fertilized eggs as part of the process. And as a result, you know, unfortunately, you lose a lot of those in that process. I have friends who went to an IVF clinic in Allentown, and there were people from all over the world who traveled there for those services. And it could also impact birth control. I'm certainly not the only woman I know who's been mansplained about how my birth control choices work. And, you know, there is a lot of misinformation about exactly the mechanisms of a lot of the birth control options out there. And we shouldn't be restricting those. We should be preserving the access to that.
Jesri, I just want to quickly get your thoughts on something that Danielle brought up just a moment ago, and that is there might be, again, a domino effect if you know, Roe is actually overturned, other landmark decisions involving privacy, like, you know, that legalizing gay marriage are on shaky ground. Is this a Republican discussion, a talking point in the party?
I'll be honest, I've never heard that once. That sounds nothing to me, to be fair. Sounds like a fear tactic. And these kinds of things, I've been in the political sphere for over a decade now, and more often than not, these types of tactics are employed when you have nothing positive to point to. I mean, this is the smoking gun of the Democrat Party, that their messaging has failed, and so their leadership is resorting to this. I mean, there's no evidence of saying, nor as I can say with confidence, there's no conversation being had within Republican circles saying, oh, now that, you know, potentially something happens with Roe v. Wade, the next move is to overturn gay marriage. That's a long logistical lift that would have to be done at the Supreme Court. And even then, given the dynamics of those justices, that would be a hard-pressed thing to see happen. Mm-hmm. So if nothing else, this goes back to what I believe to be scare political tactics to reel up the base. I mean, with these polling numbers being so low, there's not a large level of enthusiasm and motivation amongst Democrat voters going to vote for the party candidate. So they're trying to drum up this sort of support to turn out those numbers larger. In Pennsylvania, we're going to see a very close race here in the fall, where we saw President Trump won in 2016 by 1% and lose by 1% in 2020. Same with every other statewide race where Republican was close. The margin of errors on this is going to be very tight.
Danielle Gross, do you see an increase in voter turnout following this draft, or will it not do much to mobilize voters? What's your thought here?
I believe it will mobilize voters. Research and prior races have shown that this will turn races out. And, you know, last week, Kathy Rapp, who is the majority chair of the House Health Committee, said that she can confirm that Pennsylvania's legislature is already well positioned to successfully advance some of the strongest pro-life legislation in the history of our Commonwealth. So it's not just the big races on the ticket that are going to impact whether you retain the right to your medical choices. It's the state Senate and the state house races that will make a difference too.
Well, and again, there's the prospect of the state constitutional amendment, which you referenced earlier. So there is, if a resolution to amend the Constitution is passed twice by the legislature, and a number of lawmakers have introduced such legislation to curtail the right to abortion. If this is passed twice by the legislature, it then goes to the voters as a ballot question. The governor cannot veto the result. Jesri, how do you think this prospect might impact races at the state level?
Yeah, that's interesting. I will say, though, as we get in the weeds on this, it's really interesting to folks like Danielle and I who are in the weeds. However, a lot of everyday, I'll call them normal Pennsylvanians may not fully understand what that would kind of all entail. The other thing is Pennsylvania is an interesting purple state, right? Even amongst Democrats, there are a lot of pro-life Democrats, and largely due to the faith-based institutions in Pennsylvania, and not to mention some of the immigrant populations. A lot of the faith-based and immigrant populations, this is very important to them. And many of them, whether it be Democratic Catholics or places from other countries, they don't, by and large, polling has shown they are not as receptive to pro-abortion policy. So if something like this were to go on a statewide referendum, it could have a chance to pass by the populace. And look no further than our own U.S. Senator Bob Casey, who is one of the last remaining U.S. senators, Democrats, that is, who still take some pro-life positions. I just saw that as evidence that there is the appetite amongst the state population voting base for pro-life positions.
Danielle, the word abortion can be a charged word for many people. You say Democrats, particularly politicians, need to say the word abortion more. I'd like to take a case in point. You know, Connor Lamb, who is Catholic but supports abortion rights, is a congressman in a pretty conservative part of Pennsylvania. Does using the word abortion hurt or help him as he tries to get elected to the U.S. Senate?
You know, I think it helps because it calls it what it is. We need to stop worrying about euphemisms. You know, we're all adults who are voting, and we need to be very explicit that we support the right to an abortion, the right to abortion care, and the right to control what happens to our bodies in conjunction with doctors. I think it's important to call it what it is.
All right. Well, the primary is May 17th. That's next week here in Pennsylvania. Quick thumbs up or thumbs down. We talked about opening Pennsylvania's closed primaries last week. Jesri, what do you think? Opening them up or keeping them closed
to independent voters?
Sorry.
Correct. No, thanks, Mary, for the clarification for your listeners. This political guy says keep them closed. Reason being is I think it's important that if we're not nominating a person here, we're nominating a political nominee, not the general election. So
okay.
Everyone has their in the general.
10 seconds. Danielle, what do you think?
I'm a thumb sideways.
We'll get back to you on that, right?
Right.
All right. Danielle Gross, Democratic Strategist, Director of Communications at Shelley Lyons Public Affairs. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Jesri Friend, Pennsylvania Republican State Party committee member. Great to have you with us. Thank you.
Enjoyed it. Thanks, Mary and Danielle.
All right. Stay with us as the regional roundup continues.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. There are few silver linings to the COVID-19 pandemic, but one of them might be the newfound interest in gardening for people across the world. It's a phenomenon described in a recent study which found that as waves of coronavirus infections peaked in various countries, so did Google searches about flowers, vegetables, gardening techniques, and more. Experts say the mental and physical benefits of getting our hands into the earth are undisputed, though some are wondering whether many fledgling gardeners now have the time to tend to plants updates as old routines and work schedules fall back into place. We're going to discuss the many benefits of horticultural therapy and, yes, keeping that garden going if possible. Gary Altman is a certified horticultural therapist and director of the Horticultural Therapy Certificate Program in the Department of Plant Biology at Rutgers University, and he joins us in studio. Hi, Gary.
Thank you for having me, Mary.
Welcome. And we'll also be touching base in just a bit with Pamia Coleman, co-founder of Black Girls with Green Thumbs. Again, that's in just a bit. So, Gary, guessing you are not surprised by these findings that so many people across different cultures are turning to gardening during the pandemic?
Yeah, absolutely. It was a trend that was not completely surprising to me. We can see this throughout the course of history in times of uncertainty that people turn to the natural environment and growing, as a way of kind of taking that unpredicted world event that's happening and, trying to get a sense of, normalcy.
Yeah. Can horticultural therapy actually help to ease symptoms of mental health disorders like anxiety or depression? What have you found?
Yeah, I definitely think so. So just being in the mere presence of plants has been shown to lower blood pressure and, improve mood and address symptoms of depression. So being surrounded in a room of, plant-dominated space has been really triggering alone into the human body.
And even as you're surrounded by plants, you say gardening itself is a full body exercise. How so?
Yeah, absolutely. If you've ever gardened, you will know that the gardening is a full body exercise. So just pulling weeds, planting, it's repetitive, and it takes a lot of stooping, bending, which takes a toll. We don't do that every day in our daily lives. So getting out into the garden really it you can feel it the next day.
And gardens and therapy have been with us as long as humans have walked the earth?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the use of gardens and horticulture have been used in treatment for many, many years. You can think back to, palace gardens from ancient times where gardens were used prescribed for people that were not well mentally at the time. So they recognize on some level that the garden had some calming effect on the mind.
I know when you were talking to our producer, Paige Mary Bessler, you brought up Dr. Benjamin Rush, mm-hmm. who is one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, also considered to be the father of American psychiatry. And he caught on to the idea, apparently, that time spent in a garden could be helpful for people with psychiatric conditions. And this was centuries ago. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So, it wasn't until the 1800s where gardening and horticulture was put to a greater level of use. When Friends Hospital here in Philadelphia was developed, it was developed for the sole purpose of horticultural therapy. And you can see that today. The facility, as you drive by, if you know where it is, it looks very much so like a park, and that is intentional, and so that folks with psychiatric conditions can get outside and meander through the garden and walk through the trees and the grassy meadows and things like that, and experience the benefits of the garden and horticulture firsthand.
So we know that it can relieve stress. What can nature actually teach us?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great question. So I think that nature has one of the gifts of teaching us reciprocity, right? So caring for something else and learning how to care for yourself at the same time is a really important life lesson. And also just to recognize that just like how horticulture and flowers and plants, there's an ephemeral nature to them where they don't last forever. Just like our lives, we don't last forever. So if we if we are experiencing problems or issues in our lives, we either need to choose to address them and work mm-hmm. through them. Mm-hmm. And we do that through the context of the garden in the natural environment. Or we can choose to let them go and move on and establish new identities or new development of our personality through the garden.
Let's bring Pamia Coleman into the conversation. She's co-founder of the group Black Girls with Green Thumbs. Pamia, great to have you with us.
Hello.
Good morning to you.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you with us. How did your group get started?
So our group was started in 2016, and it kind of happened very organically. I was actually gifted a huge box of seeds by a family member that they received for free. And I had such an abundance of seeds that I split them down the middle, and I gave half of them to a close friend that I went to college with, my other co-founder, Latiana Tab. And we literally just started gardens randomly from this seed lot that we had. And we started to, you know, share our journey on social media, and we kind of built a following. And that turned into what our organization is today.
Well, Black Girls with Green Thumbs helps to encourage urban gardening. We do not have to have a plot of land to garden. Tell us more.
Yes, absolutely. So our organization, it works to try to better equip individuals and their families, particularly women and children that are in high need areas, just to make healthy food choices and pretty much increase their self-sufficiency through gardening. And this really contributes to mental health through wellness activities. So,
Well, many of us are disconnected from the food we eat and where it comes from. So when you work with school-age kids, Pamia, it must be a lot of fun to see them connect the dots and then get excited about growing their own food.
Yes, it's really a beautiful thing to see. I've found through working with kids in the Philadelphia School District that, you know, if you ask them, you know, where does your food come from? Most kids will tell you the supermarket. Mm-hmm. So you kind of can see that there's truly a disconnect with, you know, children in urban environments understanding food systems. So I feel like this work is very important.
Gary Altman, you talk about the benefits of joining a community garden. I guess sometimes it's just nice to be around kindred souls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Especially in the age of a pandemic where, you know, you might want to socialize and be around people that have similar interests as you, but you also want to do that in a safe way and be outdoors in the fresh air and, you know, to minimize risk of exposure to the pandemic. Community gardens play a very big role in that for many people.
And Pamia, Black Girls with Green Thumbs is involved in helping to create community gardens. I believe you were in West Oak Lane most recently?
Yes, we have a community garden happening right now at the West Oak Lane Library. We created this garden last year. This is our second year running.
So what do your gardens offer residents? What do they take away from them, aside from produce?
So during some of the programs that we run, we teach people how to start their own plants from seeds or how to transplant their plants that they may have purchased from a big box store. And we find that this really like encourages social bonds in the community. There's been a disconnect, obviously, with the pandemic, and gardening has been a really fun way to reconnect people to each other and to the earth.
So what happens if things, Pamia, don't go so well in the garden? You know, the tomatoes are attacked by hornworms, or, you know, we get a little too much rain, or maybe you know, we're just convinced that we're not any good at it. How do you approach this with the folks that you work with?
Generally, we find that gardening, even if, you know, your crops don't yield as much as you think they might, or you may have some pest issues or what have you, we find that a lot of times when it comes to how people benefit from gardening, it improves your mood. So it's kind of like the journey is more important than the destination a lot of times. So, of course, we want to eat what we grow and we want to have success in our gardens. But being there and being with other people, getting outside, getting some vitamin D, and, you know, when it does go well, it boosts your self-esteem also. So, you know, it's more about the journey than the destination sometimes, I find.
Well, that's a good thing to keep in mind because, you know, Gary, as I was watching my little plantings being lashed about by the wind and the rain this weekend, I just kind of had to walk away. You don't want to get stressed out by gardening if possible.
No, it's very much so about the process of gardening and being present with the plant and experiencing the growth and process of the garden. And failures should just be looked at as learning opportunities and not be personalized as yourself being a failure.
I've read that some countries allow doctors to fill out so-called green prescriptions. I love this. Canada is one, not the U.S. at this point anyway. Instead of prescribing medication, physicians advise patients to spend a certain amount of time with nature, say. What do you think about that, Gary? And could we make this work in the U.S.?
I think that's a wonderful idea, and it's definitely a more holistic view of healthcare and health conditions and how we can, you know, view the person as a more of a whole picture and think about how they're living their lives and making changes in their lives to improve overall health outcomes.
Go ahead.
It's a wonderful idea.
Pamia, what do you think? A green prescription.
Wonderful. Yes. And I mean, particularly because, you know, a lot of people don't think about the exercise component. You know, when you're weeding and you're digging and you're raking, these are things that, you know, again, help improve your mood and, you know, you're getting sunlight. So I think it would be a wonderful idea.
So Pamia, what's on the menu this summer? What are you growing? What are you planning?
So this summer at our West Oakland Garden, we have quite a few new food items that we're growing. One is purple corn. So we have some purple corn going. We have one of our boxes that the idea was to have like a box that had a specific color in mind. And what we chose was like this golden theme. So we're growing some yellow peppers. We have sunflowers. We have some sun gold tomatoes, which are these beautiful little tiny yellow tomatoes that are just absolutely delicious. And we also have a pollinator garden that's full of different pollinators that will attract bees and butterflies and, you know, just contribute to the beauty of the overall garden.
So what sort of pollinators have you seen in Philly in the areas in which you work?
So we tend to try to keep the pollinators natural. So I actually don't have the list of what we are going to be transplanting at the West Oak Lane Garden, but I do know that they are all, you know, naturally indigenous to the area this year.
Okay. Well, Pamia Coleman, thank you so much. It was great to have you with us. So nice of you to join us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having us.
And good luck this summer. Have fun.
Thank you. Have a good one.
All right, you too. Pamia Coleman is co-founder of Black Girls with Green Thumbs. Gary Altman, where does horticultural therapy stand in relation to other fields like art or music therapy?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I view horticultural therapy as a creative arts therapy, just like art therapy or music therapy. Most people don't view horticulture as a creative art, but I don't believe that's the case, right? It's very much like photography, where there's a technical component to using a camera and learning how to use a camera, but it takes the eye, the visual piece, that's the visual art. And I think that horticulture is the same way. There's a technical component to growing and learning the skills and being a good grower, but there's also an art to growing and designing a garden and making it visually appealing. So I very much so consider it a creative arts therapy.
How might those who do not have the physical ability tackle the physical, frankly, aspect of mm-hmm. gardening and enjoy the benefits?
Yeah, so the neat thing about horticultural therapy is that it's designed, so we design the garden so that it's accessible to everyone. And if the garden space itself cannot be changed, then we accommodate the tasks, we modify the garden space and or the activity. To make it accessible to everyone in the
everyone.
Space.
Everyone.
To everyone. No one should be denied the benefits of horticulture and engaging in plants. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we'll even bring the gardening indoors. So we'll bring planters on casters indoors so that if folks really can't get outside to the garden, say they're sensitive to the sunlight or the heat or temperature, we'll bring the garden inside to facilities as well.
Oh, sounds great. And again, you know, as the pandemic is kind of, you know, hopefully winding down and people are getting back to work, some of the projects we've all started are being set aside. How would you advise newer gardeners who find their schedules filling up and who feel they can't maintain the gardens they started? How would you advise them to move forward?
Well, I think that, taking the garden that you started, keep it up. It's a wonderful thing, and I'm sure you put a lot of effort into it. Your life may be changing as we return to some sort of normalcy or the new normalcy in life. But connecting the time spent into the garden to self-care is a good tip to remembering to engage in your garden space or linking it to something that you have to do. So you have to do some chores around the house, you know, can just throw in the garden there too so that you can remember to spend time out there and care for your plants.
We just don't want to add stress.
No, you don't want to add the stress. Yeah, the important lesson there is to just learn to incorporate it into your current daily life, even though things might be changing and returning back to normalcy.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to get your thoughts as we wrap up the conversation on this note. Listener Elizabeth sent us an email saying, a garden is a painting that takes a long time.
That's deep, yeah.
But I can imagine it.
That's true, yeah, because there's a delayed gratification to a garden. So you put so much effort into the building and the establishment of the garden and the nurturing component of it. You know, you don't always reap the benefits of the garden until...
That's okay. It forces us to slow down and look at the big picture, right?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, Gary Altman, thanks for joining us. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for coming into the studio.
Yeah, well, it was great. Gary Altman is a certified horticultural therapist and director of the Horticultural Therapy Certificate Program in the Department of Plant Biology at Rutgers University. Diana Martinez is our engineer today, our producer, Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thank you so much for joining us for the Regional Roundup. Be well.